Blog Talk Radio.
Let's say you're one of those people who's not afraid of hard work. Let's drive and pick up. Okay, drive and pick up.
Thanks to Hamlet Hawk in Iceland for the music. Tonight we have Vilma Reynoso and Peter B. Roth in the first hour. And in the second hour, Jordan Scott joins me. But right now I'd like to give a shout out to Mike Walker, who not only gives me support, but he definitely has my back and eases my life a great deal. So first, welcome Vilma and Peter.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
I haven't had a couple on as guests before, so I'm excited about that. And particularly since you have so much in common. So why don't we start out with you, Vilma, just tell us a bit about yourself. And I will say that you can be found at VilmaReynoso.com.
Yes, hi, I'm glad to be here. I am basically a personal development life coach. I definitely am a vegan health lifestyle advocate. I am a nouveau vegan, a raw foodist, excuse me, and an ebook editor. I guess I could start with the life coaching if that's okay with you.
Okay.
Okay. Basically what I do is I help people make positive changes in their lives so they can live more joyful and purposeful. I help people get from point A to point B and point C. Basically, if they're stuck or feeling like they're stuck with something in their life, I help them and motivate them to change for the better, to eliminate, you know, disempowering behaviors or thoughts, and, you know, guide them towards a better life. And basically the way I do this is by coaching either in person or on the phone. The first thing I do, would be I assess whether I can help them with, like, a 15-minute conversation or so. And if I can help them, then we set up a schedule to either meet in person or talk on the phone. And I also, before we meet, I also give them basically a questionnaire. It's about 10 questions, and this is just for me to help me to learn more about them, especially if I don't know them from Adam. So I learn, I ask them specific questions, and I learn about more about their life so I can determine if there's other areas that they actually need help in that they don't see. And I approach this from a holistic perspective because I approach life that way. I believe that life should be lived holistically from a spiritual perspective, a healthy physical life, and a healthy mental and emotional life.
Right.
And so if one of those components is missing, I guide them towards incorporating that in their lives.
All right. Well, I'm going to ask you more about that, but I want to get Peter in here. PeterBRoth.com.
Okay.
And Peter, tell us just a little bit about you, and then I'll have questions for both of you.
Sure. Yeah, I'm a transformational spiritual healer, and what I mean by that is that I use my intuition, Qigong, astrology, and nutrition in my practice to help one increase their well-being and sense of fulfillment. So if someone comes to me, they usually might have an ache or a pain or something along those lines, and they may be more interested in the Qigong intuitive approach than the astrology, but other people, they might be more interested in their life and what do they not know about themselves, or what patterns in life are likely to occur in the present or near future, or what was going on in the past, and that's where astrology can come in handy. And so there are some clients who like to have a combination of both, and so that's basically how I help people.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also a teacher, writer, and even an entertainer as well.
Huh? An entertainer yet? Is that true, Vilma?
Yes. Well, definitely.
Okay. Well, how did the two of you, separately or individually, decide? I mean, what made you decide to actually use your skills to help others as coaches and healers?
Did you want me to answer?
Sure, you can start out.
Okay. I basically feel that is my gift. I've been helping people probably my entire adult life. People just naturally come to me to ask for advice, or mm-hmm. and they say that I'm a very good listener. And I always wanted to help people. And I just decided, you know what, this is something that I probably should try and do. And I just decided a couple years ago to do this, you know, as a business. I've been doing it part-time and would like to do it almost on a full-time basis.
Mm-hmm.
So I just felt that it was my gift, and I have, you know, natural intuition to kind of hone in on really what is deeply bothering people and what they need to do to change. So that's why I decided to do it.
So you actually have that type of a gift. So you didn't go through some type of training or something for...
I did not. I looked for training classes or certifications, but I didn't find that anything that I really liked so far anyway. And, you know, I've been life coached myself. I've also studied a little bit with another life coach that kind of helped me to actually coach.
Mm-hmm.
I don't, you know, have a certification per se, but I feel that it's something that I do naturally. And, you know, to be honest, you either can relate to people and you have it, and it's not something that
can
really taught.
Yeah.
Know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah,
definitely. And certifications, for a lot of people, mean that that's just something people put on their walls. It doesn't mean anything. Or at least not that much. So how would someone be able to contact you? What's the best way?
Well, they can always go to my website. It's my name, VilmaReynoso.com. I'm also on Facebook and Twitter under my name.
Okay, so your name. That's it. Yeah.
And then on the website, I have my phone number and, you know, my email address.
Okay, so it's actually easy then to connect with you. Peter, what
yes.
about you? What made you just know that this was the right path for you?
Well, basically, what Vilma said.
Okay.
No, I...
Okay, we'll say ditto and go from there.
No, actually, there is some truth to that. My story is kind of similar. Ever since I was a kid, I've kind of always had an interest in well-being and taking good care of oneself and spirituality. And, you know, over the years as I matured, got more and more proficient with things like intuition. And I studied astrology from my teenage days, and I picked up Qigong and got training in that beginning in 2006. So that's something a lot more recent. But I seem to have a natural aptitude for it, and of course I had I really enjoyed it very much. So it was so easy, and everything just flowed, and people seem to be appreciative of the service that I provide, and I get a blast from each session that I do, and it's really an enjoyment to, you know, help someone overcome an ache or pain, or even make a breakthrough in their consciousness of something that previously did not make any sense, or seeing something that they hadn't seen before. All those just give me a natural high. So
yeah.
I guess that would be my story.
Well, just being able to do what you love is a blessing. So you're very fortunate. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry, I just said that's true, absolutely.
Yeah, I do. I always feel bad for people who are in some horrible job and they think, you know, they're going to stick it out until they retire, that type of thing. I mean, it's surviving, but it's not my definition of living. So,
exactly.
No. Peter, what was the best way to contact you?
Well, my website is a pretty darn good way, peterbroth.com, as you mentioned before. And mm-hmm. on that website, you'll see an email contact and also a phone number that's toll-free. And I also am on Twitter and Facebook, Peter B. Roth, in both cases. You can find me pretty easily.
Okay. I love that. You both are just using your own name. There's none of this funny stuff. Which sometimes makes me crazy.
Well, I have a good reason for that.
But I wonder, how did you, I mean, you well, I think, Vilma, you were born in Argentina, but you've spent most of your life here, I think.
Yes.
And Peter, so how did you get from that standard American diet, we say SAD with capital S-A-D, to... raw vegan? Both of you, either of you go first. And how long ago?
You want to go first? Okay.
Sure. That's okay. I was born in Argentina, and my parents migrated here when I was four.
Okay.
So I've been here, you know, I consider myself an American. I've been
obviously
most of my life. I grew up with the standard American diet and the Argentine diet, which is probably worse than the standard American diet.
Really?
A lot of red meat.
In either case, it's SAD, so.
Exactly. We grew up eating a lot of red meat, a lot of pasta, a lot of dairy. You know, every Sunday, my father would have a barbecue and invite all his friends, and we'd eat the whole cow, literally. So, you know, I grew up with a lot of it. And as a child, I was pretty ill, had asthma and sinus problems and colds all the time. By the time I was a young adult, you know, my asthma got worse. I still had the same ailments. And then I suppose... in my 30s and early 40s, my health got worse. I was overweight. I had, very painful fibroids. Still had the sinus problems, asthma. I was depressed. I had chronic fatigue. I just got to the point where, while I was going through my divorce, I got to the point where I said to myself, "This has got to stop. I've got to do something about my health." And I had read about vegetarianism.
Mm-hmm.
I was married. I tried to go vegetarian then, but it was difficult with my ex-husband. So I couldn't do it. Then by the time I was going through my divorce, I decided I'm going to go vegetarian. And I did it only for health reasons. And I did it, and... kind of went cold turkey, just stopped eating chicken and meat and fish, and it wasn't that hard, to be honest. That transition was not difficult for me.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I still ate the eggs, I still have the dairy and the cheese. My health improved a little bit. I started losing a little bit of weight. I started exercising and running, which I used to love and have stopped, and now I still do that. So my health improved a little bit, and then I did that, and so I went vegetarian in 2008, and then in 2010, I decided to go vegan, and the reason why was I had started meeting a bunch of other vegans online and some in person, and they started, you know, I started learning about the treatment of animals, and I had no idea how horrible it was. No idea. I didn't know about factory farms. I was kind of ignorant. And I just was kind of in shock at what I was told. And so I started looking into the vegan diet and realized that this is even healthier. I need to do this. And then at one point, a friend of mine gave me a movie to watch, Earthling. It basically explains the treatment of animals worldwide. And I watched it. I couldn't finish it. I think I watched two-thirds of it, and I was just in shock. I went vegan overnight, and I said, I cannot participate in this anymore. I cannot be part of this. I have to be part of the solution. And I was done. I went vegan overnight. That was 2010, I think May of 2010. And then my health improved. My sinuses just stopped having sinus issues. Asthma went away. Fibroids weren't hurting more. I obviously wasn't depressed or anything like that.
Right.
But I didn't, you know, I ate cooked food. I ate, you know, the packaged vegan food that we have as replacements for eating, you know, fish, dairy, or meat, which were fine. They were great, but they weren't the healthiest thing to be eating, as time went on, I started realizing that it's probably best to start eating more fresh food. And I, at the same time, I started meeting more vegans online and raw vegans, and they were in phenomenal health. And I just thought, wow, I want that, you know?
Yeah.
I started looking into that, and I tried eating raw food for a month, and almost succeeded, and I started feeling even better. And I just couldn't believe how well I felt. And then I kind of dabbled back into the, you know, eating cooked food, and then finally by about March of this year, I decided, you know what, I need to do this. I'm going to go raw vegan. And I asked Peter if he would want to do it with me, and I challenged him to do it for 21 days. And I remember at the time that he was a little hesitant in doing it. And, you know, it's just been, it's been a heck of a journey ever since.
Well, Peter, what's your story?
Well, I remember when I was a little tyke, I'm guessing 3, 4 years old, probably 4, I'm guessing. I remember one day realizing that what I was eating in front of me was this fish. And I don't know how I finally understood this, but I realized this fish died and now I'm eating it. And that didn't feel good to me. And I thought, well, what can I do? I'm just a kid. I mean, I got to do what my parents say. And so, you know, I kind of stuffed those feelings down for many years as, you know, I ate the standard American diet. At the very least, I'm grateful that in my teen years, my mom walked into my bedroom one day and declared that she's going to cook and prepare healthy food. And, you know, we'd be avoiding sugar and taking it easy on salt and stuff like that. And I remember when she said that, something in me just clicked, and I said, I'm with you. I fully support this. And so I became a health food nut in my early teen years, and but it wasn't until 1992, so 20 years ago, that in my young adult years, I finally realized, hey, wait a second, I'm an adult here, and I can decide what I eat or don't eat. And I remember when I was a kid, I didn't want to eat dead animals or kill animals and eat them. So I decided right then and there to become a lacto-vegetarian, which means that I didn't eat flesh foods and I didn't eat eggs, only dairy. And the only reason why I ate dairy was at the time I bought into the myth that I needed to get a good source of protein, and I figured, okay, I can get that with dairy, and at least I'm not killing any animals to get that supposedly good source of protein.
Right.
But, over the next 9 years, you know, I too came in contact with more and more vegans and learned more about the real deal. And you know, after 9 years of doing dairy, I had it. I said, all right, I'm sick and tired of all this phlegm and stuffiness and, you know, irritable digestion and all that. And I said, okay, I'm going vegan. I'm going to feel better philosophically because I'm not exploiting any animals in the process anyway. So that in 2001, I became a vegan and was flying high. But the funny thing is, not long after I became vegan, I met a raw foodist. And he was kind of like an inspiration for me because I knew eating a raw vegan diet made total sense to me mentally, but I just didn't think I could support it. I mean, because I wasn't a big salad fan, and I didn't like to eat a lot of fruit, and I thought, I just don't know how this could possibly work for me. And so speed ahead to this year, it was February this year that Vilma said, hey, how about beginning March, we do a totally raw vegan diet for 21 days. Just see how it goes. And so I hemmed and hawed a little bit, and then I said, you know what? This is like a dream of mine. I've got a girlfriend who's going to be right there with me. I couldn't ask for better support, so why not at least give it a try and see what happens? And so I did, and, you know, after day 21, I asked myself, do I want to go back? And I said, no, not really. I feel much better. I don't miss some of the things that, like cereal in the morning. I didn't think I could give that up, but it was so easy when you have a bowl of fruit salad or fruit in general. I just learned that, wow, this is much better than I remembered. And so now for almost most every morning I have some fruit, either, you know, a few kinds of fruit, or I might have a fruit salad, but in either case, it's just so delicious. And then, you know, go to dinner, I have a veggie salad, and I've become quite a proficient salad maker, so that I can make a salad that tastes incredibly wonderful. And I don't always put dressing either, and people sometimes are amazed at that, but it's true. And so, yeah, I don't want to go back to cook food. I mean, sometimes on the road, I do have some cooked food, but I definitely notice how heavy I feel.
Yeah.
And it's just more incentive to stay on the raw diet.
Yeah. It's funny, isn't it, how something like that, I mean, once you get clean, it won't take much. I mean, just like you say, a meal on the road, and all of a sudden, you're back there. I live by myself. And so, you know, that's a good thing right now. But I go to relatives and, you know, I try to do the salads, but there's always something else around, and I just don't feel good. And so I've made up my mind. I mean, you know, I'm taking my food or getting it when, you know, I don't have to eat what they're eating because it doesn't, I mean, they don't care. They love me anyway, right? I mean,
yeah.
You know. It's not going to depend on, oh, you know, I made this so she's got to eat it or she doesn't love me or I won't love her, you know. Because so much so in our country, I think the whole socializing and everything is around food. And some parents just, you know, stuff the kids, oh, I love you, you know, here, have this. Oh, you fell down, you hurt yourself, here, have a candy bar. We have all these emotions attached to food. But then after your 21 days, you both just looked at each other and said, okay, this was good. We're going to stick with it.
Yeah, not only that, but not long after we completed, I think a month and a half, we decided to try a regimen of four liver cleanses, you know, once a month.
Oh. So what did that consist of? I've been hearing more and more about that kind of thing.
Well, Vilma, you want to say about that?
Well, it's basically they want you to do it every, at least, you have to wait at least every 3 weeks. So we did it once a month.
Mm.
And if I can remember all of it here, it was you have to prepare for it a week ahead of time or so. Can help me out here, Peter.
Apple juice, you prepare by drinking apple juice, like a quart, I think, of apple juice every day for like 5 days.
Okay.
And then on the sixth day, that's when you do the actual flush. And that consists of grapefruit, a concoction of grapefruit and olive oil, which you down just before you hit the sack. And then you just, while you're sleeping, you're in a certain position so you don't throw
also
up. What was that?
There's Epsom salt as well. Remember that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, you have to prepare earlier in that flush day with a couple of rounds of Epsom salt solution. And then you have the concoction. Go to bed. If you have to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night, do so. And the next morning, you have a couple more rounds of Epsom salts.
Oh,
and
wow.
And then you gradually go back to eating. You know, you start off with some juice, then some fruit, then eat lightly, and then, you know. So it's actually a pretty simple process.
Yeah.
And we did it four times.
Yeah, it's not more complicated than it is. It's actually very simple.
Yeah.
And, you know, you release stones from your liver that are they're in there. They've been in there for decades from eating, the fat diet. And you don't know they're there. And it's a healthy way of releasing them instead of having surgery or something.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right.
I mean,
so we did that about four times, I think.
Yep, four times.
Because you have to do it more than once because they're sometimes they're really lodged in there. Especially me that I've been eating meat most of my life, so you know I'm.
Right. I mean, we can't expect to just spend a weekend doing something and get rid of everything that it's taken us 30, 40, 50 years to clog us up. But how did you come to be a couple? I mean, now Peter's been, vegetarian for 20 years, and you just started about 4 years ago. And so how did you meet? How did this come about? And did it have anything to do with
First of all, Vilma has been here for 20 years in Colorado, and I had to get my butt over here to Colorado. Otherwise, I don't think we would have met. But I moved to Colorado back in 2010, and then Vilma and I, we met on Facebook in 2011. You want to take it from here, Vilma?
Sure. I actually liked his note to self, which he's going to talk about later, I think, on Facebook, so that caught my attention. So anyway, we met on Facebook and really didn't have a lot of interaction other than just kind of reading each other's statuses, I think. And then we met in person about 2 months later at VegFest, which is a just celebration for vegetarians and vegans here in Denver. It's held once a year. It's like it's a festival. There's a bunch of vendors. And that's when we met in person. And we also belonged to the same meetup back then. And we saw each other at different meetups, kind of got to know each other a little bit better. And started talking. We basically started dating about 4 months after that.
Okay. So, had either of you had experiences dating people who weren't vegan or vegetarian after you became? And how did that work?
Oh, yeah. I certainly have experience in that.
I have too.
I've found that dating vegetarians are definitely a lot easier. But I was even married at one point to a how do you say it, a flaming meat eater.
Flaming meat eater, that'll do.
I was too, but I was also a meat eater then too, though. Fuck.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't. I was a vegan then, and so it was kind of challenging. It was a vegan household, but you know, when we went out to eat, it's like I kind of had to avert my eyes and focus on what I was eating because I didn't want to look at what she was eating. Whenever I've dated people who weren't even vegetarian, that's been a little bit rough. And then the vegetarians seem to be a little more sympathetic, but I'm trying to think. I think Velma was the first vegan that I actually dated. So, I mean, it was like a breath of fresh air.
For sure. Yeah. I know when I first became vegetarian, I was still disconnected. I did it for ethical reasons, but I dated, you know, a lot of people who weren't. But I know as time went on, it was sort of harder and harder. And after I became vegan, it was just like, man. I mean, I have a vegetarian in my life now, and who knows, he may go a little further, but he's in it for the animals, so he may not eat the healthiest diet, but his compassion is, you know, there. It is sort of hard, though, like you're saying, you don't want to sit across from somebody that's got this big bone in their hand and they're gnawing away. There's something about that that's really pretty sad. I don't know.
Literally.
yeah, right. There we go. Puns are always welcome.
All right.
Okay. So what would you say makes your relationship, because you both have very good energy separately and together, that is obvious. So what makes your relationship so special?
Well, I think first and foremost, we just get each other at every level, I'd say. I mean, we have a similar sense of humor. We have a similar spirituality and philosophy about life. We have similar goals. I mean, not that we don't have our differences. We do.
For sure, you're human. Yeah.
No, actually opposite, astrologically.
Yeah. She's a Cancer. I'm a Capricorn. But yet... I know going into the relationship, I was a little bit leery, it looks like, because I've had some challenges with cancers after Velma. But she just, she made cancer kind proud, I guess, because it's like she has been absolutely wonderful, and my faith in cancers has been restored, so thank you, Velma.
Okay. Well, you actually use astrology, don't you, Peter? In some of your
I do.
Yeah. So of course you would be checking that out pretty closely.
Oh yeah.
Well, are you working on any projects together or thinking about some? Because it seems like you would be good in either doing a class, writing a book, or something together.
We are in the process of developing classes that we'd like to teach, more like workshops.
Right.
I think we call play shops instead of workshops. Mm-hmm. So it'll be something fun to do, not something that's long and boring.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, so we have some, we've got maybe four different play shops in development now. One of them we thought of doing was discussing how to have healthy relationships versus unhealthy ones. How to attract healthy people and healthy relationships. Basically, how to make yourself well so you can attract what you want in your life. So something like that.
Okay.
And then.
I'm sorry, and then what was the last one?
And then a second one would be we're thinking about doing a workshop on vegan living.
Okay.
The purpose of being vegan, just giving some practical steps to if whoever's interested in becoming vegan. Something along that line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be really good because a lot of people, they decide they're going to be vegan, but they don't understand how many of the products we use every day unthinkingly are not vegan.
Right.
And in our actions and companies we buy from and things like that. So that's a whole, that could be a big play shop, really.
Yes, it could be.
Yeah.
And then just to help people get started, you know, because I think people have, it's in their heart that they don't know what to do. You know, they don't know how to take step one. And I think that would be helpful as well.
Right. Well, and if they have people around them who are, isn't it funny how you become vegetarian or vegan and everyone around you all of a sudden is a nutrition expert? You've found.
Yeah, no, right.
I mean, it's like, oh, where are you going to get your protein? Well, you've got to eat dairy. This and that. And it's like if you aren't firm and don't have some support and some facts, you can waver and because you think, well, maybe they're right. Maybe I can't
exactly.
do this.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Good point.
So, and that's something like you both, well, you found each other on Facebook. I mean, there are such wonderful vegan groups on Facebook. I am just inspired and blown away just every day.
Oh, yeah.
The support is there. And I mean, everybody wants to help. So, you know, if you are one of those people who's surrounded by people in your physical life that are against you or they're worried for your health, you know, just hang in there with some groups on Facebook. I mean, it can save you.
I agree.
Yeah. When do you think that you're working on these play shops, like you're calling them? When do you think you might want to start in? Now, will these be live and in person, or are they going to be online?
Well, that's a good question. That is something that still needs to be determined, the audience. But it's hard to say when they'll be ready. It's because we're still at kind of the inspirational stage and working mm-hmm. out what different elements need to be expounded upon. That's the word I'm looking
right.
for. And like for instance, another play shop we're considering is personal fulfillment and living a joyful life, that type of thing. And you know, considering different talents and areas of expertise that we have. You know, in that area, I was thinking one of the things I've felt a calling to do is to take my knowledge of chi and take it to like the next level. Instead of most people think of chi as like at the personal level, but I think we could work some incredible magic if we look at it from a more transpersonal level. And the ancients had a term for that called wu wei, which means effortless action. And, you know, Vilma's and my coming together, our lives together, has just been one instance of wu wei after another. It's just incredible the magic that happens and how in sync we are a lot of times. Like, even tonight, you know, we called each other at the exact same time, and as a result, we couldn't talk to each other because we're going to each other's voicemail. And it's not always... The most pleasant of synchronicities. It can be frustrating if you're in a hurry or something, but in retrospect, it's usually always humorous. Humorful, if that's a word. But anyway, yeah. So it's I'm thinking that would be a class that I think or a place up that people would really eat up and you know getting a little more conscious of how they can apply some of the principles of intention, spontaneity, alertness, gratitude, and the like into manifesting fulfillment. And then the final play shop we're working on would be something like spiritual activism. And a lot of conventional activism, you know, is doing your marches, your protests, and writing letters and stuff. It's focused on the outer world, which of course is important.
Sure.
But there are other more subtle aspects that are important that I think sometimes get neglected, like taking good care of yourself and living a more sustainable lifestyle where your activism and the life you live are one and the same. They're not separate things that you do, like, oh, I'm going to go and do this activist thing over here, and then I'm going to come back and live my normal life. No.
Right.
There's a way to incorporate the activism into your life, so it's one and the same. And so those are, that kind of gives you a flavor for some of the things we're working on. And stay tuned. We'll let the public know when we're ready with any one of those.
Okay. So play shops. Then what about books? You've both published before. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? And let me know if you're thinking of publishing together.
Sure. Do you want to go first, Velma?
Sure. I'm working on a series of recipe books, actually. They'll be e-books.
Oh, okay. Cool.
That's exciting. I don't have an ETA, but... that's what I'm working on right now. I'm also working on another book that's it's going to be a physical book, an inspirational book that I'm writing.
Yeah.
So that's exciting. And as far as both of us writing together, to be honest, we haven't thought about that yet, but I'm liking the idea.
Yeah, well,
yeah,
I mean, that might just be sort of a natural outgrowth of doing the play shops together.
I was going to say that. Yep.
Well, there you go.
What I got going writing is I've got my blog, just like Velma. You can check that out. I haven't been contributing to that in a while because I've been so focused on. I've got two books that I'm working on now, but I have published one book in conjunction with a bunch of other people. It's called Small Ways to Make a Big Difference. And you can get more information about that on my website. But I'm working on a book on a new system of astrology, and I'm really excited about that. But there's a lot to put into that book, so Lord knows when I'm going to finish that. So in the meantime, the public has been clamoring for a book of a compilation of my notes to self that some of the listeners out there might be familiar with that I publish, you know, just about every weekday. And,
right.
And,
I see.
So I am feverishly working on getting that ebook published, so it'll be out in time for the holidays, which I know is just right around the corner. So I'm going to be a busy boy this weekend.
Yeah. Okay. Well, and so, I was going to say, all right, you're working on the e-books. Velma's working on e-books. And another, you guys are really living, well, you're walking your talk, which is actually the only way to do it. Well, there becomes a time when you just... either have to or just forget it, I think. That has to do with being authentic. We've learned about that. I did want to mention that I did read in Peter's notes to himself that you went to a yoga retreat in Brazil.
Ah, yes. That's in my blog, actually.
Right, right. Would you just talk about that? Because that was the first time you manifested something really big. And I know that that's been the base for so much now.
Yes, and I just love that story. Basically, the story begins back in high school when I took a music composition class, and one of the songs we analyzed was The Girl from Ipanema, which is a very famous Brazilian song that was a big hit in this country back in the mid-60s. And I had certainly heard it before, but it was almost like Providence was reminding me, hey, you need to look more into this. Okay, well, fine. So as I started to look more into this, I bought records by that composer, Antonio Carlos Jobim, and I just fell in love with his music in general. And so over the years, I was just a big bossa nova fan, and that's the style of music that I am referring to here. And then back in the mid-90s, it occurred to me, you know what? I would really love to see the land where this beautiful music comes from and see what inspired such beauty. And so I put together, I started to realize, let's try some of these metaphysical principles. And so I said, all right, number one, I need to start preparing. I have no idea how I'm going to manifest this, or if I can even afford this, but I'm just going to pretend that I'm gonna do it. So I started studying the Portuguese language and reading about Brazil and Rio and all that stuff. And next thing you know, I see an advertisement for a yoga retreat in Brazil, and I thought, well, I'm not really much into yoga, but what the heck? Maybe I can at least go to the introductory meeting, and maybe they'll give me some ideas of how to get to Brazil. So I went to the meeting, and I loved the people there. And, before the meeting was over, I realized, you know what? What the heck? Let's try this yoga thing, and I'll just commit to going. And, you know, worst case, at the last minute, I'll back out because I have, like, about, I think a month and a half before I have to absolutely commit to going or not. And so after I went home that day and went to bed, woke up the next morning to a phone call, which said, hey, are you interested in getting a job over at Microsoft? Because I was unemployed at the time. Well, we have a temporary job for you over there. Are you interested? And I said, interested? Of course. So I went over to the interview and passed it. They hired me immediately, and so there was my funds. Wow, thanks, universe. And so I worked and raised plenty of money in time before I had to say adios and fly down to Brazil, and I had an incredible time. And every time I think of that story, it brings a tear to my eye, because it's like, yeah, that was a deep felt dream come true.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
That's excellent. Because people, they think it always happens to somebody else. Well, you know, they made it happen or they worked really hard for it. But we can manifest. And
absolutely.
That's proof. And when you see that, like you say, I mean, your first time, and you still get misty because it was, it's life changing.
Exactly.
I wanted to ask Vilma a little bit about, you have a daughter.
I do.
Is she doing raw food too, or what's happening there?
She's doing, with me, she does a little bit of cooked, vegan, and raw.
Mm-hmm.
I can't go 100% raw. It's a little too difficult.
Okay.
She loves fruit. So, she basically eats tomatoes almost every day and avocados.
Oh, man, that sounds great to me.
And it's funny because when I was pregnant with her, I craved fruit. And this is when I was actually a meat eater, when I was pregnant. And I just, all I wanted to eat was fruit. It was just so weird. And I had no idea that when, after I had her, that she just would love fruit. And she's always loved fruit. So, yeah, it's interesting. But she's with her father, you know, 50% of the time, and he does eat meat. So I think she does eat, you know, animals at his house.
Okay.
But when she's with me, she's vegan.
And she doesn't say anything, or it doesn't seem to bother her?
It does a little bit. She's starting to make sense of it. I don't want to, you know, push it on her.
Right.
She understands. You know, we have two cats, and, you know, she loves them. She's always loved animals. And I think she's starting to make the connection, but she hasn't completely done it yet.
Yeah.
And I can't, you know, unfortunately, I can't control what goes on in his household. So I.
Right. Yeah.
She's still a little bit young to be able to demand what she wants to eat.
Right.
So it's a little difficult right now.
Yeah. But, well, at least you know that she's healthier for eating vegan while she's with you. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a good thing. I wanted to ask both of you, because you had mentioned something about meetups or. I guess there has to be vegan meetups. What do you think about the meetups, and how would somebody go about that in their own community, finding
a vegan meetup?
Mm-hmm.
Basically, that you would go to the website and just type in the search section, just type in vegans or just vegan group, something like that, and then it should pop up.
Yeah.
Oh, you want to also put the city where you live, too.
Yeah, in the city where you live.
Sure. Okay. Are the groups pretty good? I mean, have you've gone to them? You've seen them?
Yes. Actually, I was going to say, I'm actually an organizer for one of the vegan meetups here in Denver. It's called Denver Vegans.
Okay.
It's not raw, but it's, you know, just for any vegan. And, Peter and I are actually going to be hosting monthly Rollicks, where it's a potluck where you bring raw food.
Okay,
and it's on the meetup. It's you can look there to find the information. It's basically every first Saturday of every month starting in January.
That's going to be fun, I think.
Yeah, and it's just for anyone who's interested in, you know, the vegan lifestyle, want to learn a little more about it, or a seasoned raw foodist, you know, as well.
Yeah. Well, since you don't do the cooking, what would you say in your kitchen is your favorite tool or utensil or appliance?
For me, it would have to be my blender.
The blender.
Because I'm a smoothie queen. I love to make smoothies.
Ah, okay.
And then it would be, you know, also my juicer, and I have a dehydrator as well. But I use the blender more.
Okay. Peter, what about you?
It would have to be my girlfriend, because she's a genius.
Oh, wow.
I love all the tools.
You've got the tools.
Well,
okay.
Okay. In all seriousness, I would have to say it would be my brain, because this diet has forced me to exercise creative muscles I didn't even know I had. And as a result, even when I'm by myself, I've created some delicious meals. So, you know, I think that's one of the big secrets that, you know, might get overlooked a lot is your brain. That's the most important tool you can have on this diet.
Okay, that's true probably of a lot of things, because our brains are important. And the brains are better if you're putting good things in your body. So
absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. What would you like to leave? We've got 6 minutes almost left. What would you like to leave the listeners with as far as advice or advice?
I there's one thing that comes to mind that we haven't talked about a lot. Vilma hinted at it, and that is I think our journey here on the raw food diet is that it has been the hardest change for both of us in terms of changing our diet by far. You know, becoming vegetarian and vegan were nothing compared to this. And I've seen other people to try the raw vegan diet, and they don't last very long on it. And I think Vilma's and my experience have kind of shown why that is. And I think one of the reasons why that is there's definitely an emotional component that needs to be addressed. Like there are, there's comfort foods, there's addictions that have to be, you don't just eliminate them or say, no, I'm not going to do that anymore. You have to replace it with something that can reinforce a new pattern of behavior and a new desire. And you have to, I think it's good to contrast raw food versus cooked food, which we've done at times, and really notice the difference. So it's not just you're giving blind allegiance to this new diet. You're actually seeing the benefits on, you know, physical, emotional, and mental, and spiritual levels.
Yeah. Yeah, because all of these are so interconnected. And that's what, like, you had said that you had done this for the health reasons, Vilma. But then you watched Earthlings, and that totally wiped you out. I think a lot of people get in it for health, and then the ethical reasons come later. Some people like me go into it for the ethical reasons. And, in fact, there's a Facebook group that really the people there have come into it for the animals. And you can tell by some of the recipes and some of the things that they're eating that, you know, you really wouldn't want to. I mean, but because they aren't worrying so much about the health aspects, but they're really worried about the animals, and they're very compassionate people. So people come at it from all ways, but usually after a while it sort of seems to blend together, because if you're around other vegans, you start learning, and it meshes somehow.
Definitely.
So we can find out more about each of you, VilmaReynoso.com and PeterBRoth.com. You're both on Facebook with the same names and Twitter with the same names. That's impressive.
Yeah, well, we're twins.
I mean, I have trouble with people with these strange names they give themselves. And in the pagan world, that happens too, especially with Wiccans. They come up with some amazing names.
you mean they ask, which name are you?
Which name are you? That was one thing I've never fallen into. I've always used my own name. It's like, well, this is what it is. So.
You know that way, and you have to change your website. The name of your website. It's always your name.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You reinvent yourself, but you don't change your name. So, you know, that's why
right.
I did it.
Right.
And you know, I mean, there are people who, for whatever reason, and I know I have friends from other countries who are living in countries where they really don't want to put their name out there with what they're saying. And I understand that. But other than that, I mean, I just have to laugh at it. So I don't know. But thank you both so much. And I would like to have you back when you get the play shops underway and talk about those, because I think that's just going
to
be fun. I liked all the topics, and it's going to be a good thing. So thank you very much. And
thank you.
Well, keep up the good work. You guys are an inspiration, really.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You.
Okay. Good night.
Thanks. Good night. It's camouflaged and it's live. If we know of him and his activity, we can see through his lies. Camouflaged in 1740 by camouflaged.
In the beginning. beginning of September, you'll find daughtersofisis.com fully functional and waiting for you to go on over and make your purchases of any of our oils or our flower essence formulas or misters or powders, potions, and brews, because we've even got teas. That's the ancestor of aromacology over at daughtersofisis.com. Thank you now for coming by to see us. We appreciate it.
Well, and now for our second hour, we have Jordan Scott, who is a master's candidate in international studies at DePaul University in Chicago. Hi, Jordan.
Hello, how's it going?
Hello.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Jordan, what happened here?
Can you hear me?
Jordan?
Hold on. Let me call back.
Hello? Jordan?
Hello.
Hi. Okay, I got dropped by Skype. So that's what's happening here.
I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, well, you know, you had trouble when you called in before or tried to. I mean, you know, there's always something with Blog Talk or Skype. I don't know. But I can't, don't know what to do about that. Okay, so anyway, I was going to say, you're in Chicago now, and you have come quite a ways from Florida to be in the cold weather.
Yes, I have, and I'm actually very excited to be up here and working on my master's, and ultimately I want to pursue my PhD in international studies or sociology once I am finished at DePaul.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, what you're going to do with this. How did you get interested in international studies?
Well, I grew up as a soccer player, and obviously soccer being the international sport, I was around people from all different cultures, and also I went to a high school. In North Florida, it was the only high school that had the ESOL program, English as a Second Language, and so basically, we had kids from all around the world, and they all played for the soccer team. They were from different countries in Africa. I played with a number of Arabs. I played with Persians. I played with Asians and South Americans and Central Americans and Caribbean Islanders. And
oh my God.
That always has given me it gave me an international perspective from a very young age, and it got me very interested in it. And then when I was in college, I originally majored in economics, but I figured out very quickly that economists make me very angry a lot with the way that they think and the way that they view things, even though in international studies I integrate economics a lot into it, but I take a perspective that is much different than your typical bourgeois economist.
I know you do, because I know your politics. So I think that's interesting, though, because, well, I should say I think I know your politics pretty much. Okay, you're talking about bourgeois, and yes, the regular capitalist economics is totally different from where you're coming from. But will you be, when you're in school now, are you specializing in a certain part of the world, or are you specializing more in issues?
Well, typically in my field, students specialize in this particular part of the world, but I specialize in particular issues, specifically critiques of capitalism and social justice. Well, not critiques of social justice, but looking at social justice issues and critiquing capitalism how they relate to social justice issues. That can be anywhere from wars to poverty to in the realms of education and health, anything in those fields.
Wow. So, there, I mean, it's almost an umbrella. There's so much that fits in it.
Absolutely, absolutely. And some of the countries that I have done research on, obviously, Norway has been my most recent research. Norway as a model for social justice throughout the world. Also, I've done some, I follow Venezuelan politics. In my early years as an international studies student, I did a lot of research in China, not actually in China, but on China. And Latin America, I've been to Argentina. So I'm sort of eclectic in that sense. But I always bring it back to social justice globally and also social justice in the United States. Even though I'm an international studies student, I've lived in the United States my whole life, and I've witnessed a lot of social justice issues, within the country, and it's easy for me to relate anything I learned about any other country to what's going on here in the United States.
Right. And because this one, no matter what some people might have you believe, is not free of injustice by any means.
Well, absolutely not. I mean, justice runs very closely down the lines of race in this country, and it has since the beginning, and it continues to do so, although you do see some deviations, you know, your Herman Cain's of the world that are very, very conservative, but really that's just a tool of the capitalist world to say, well, you see, you know, Herman Cain succeeded, so,
exactly.
You know, you're black, you should be able to do the exact same thing.
Right.
Even though the levels of oppression on minorities in this country are still very high, and I'm a white person myself, a white male, and I think that it's important as a white male to recognize white male privilege and that it still exists.
I agree. If you want to see racism at its finest, just look at a prison population. And, you know, because, like, people of color in this country are not a large percentage, but yet in prison, a very high percentage. And now we just had another, I forget his name, but a young man in Florida was just killed again, a young black man. The Stand Your Ground law is coming into place again.
Was this a new thing since Trayvon Martin?
This is a new one, just in the past couple days. I've been reading.
Oh, wow, I haven't heard about that.
Yeah, to be young and black in this country is terrifying, I think. And so you're right as far as you understand that you're young white male, and so far right now that is quite a privilege.
Yes, absolutely.
I shouldn't even call it a privilege, but it's... it's just one of those, like, it's a guilt.
There's the benefits that go along with it, whether you ask for them or not. And I'm not gonna sit here and say that I've had it, smooth and well. But I always look at it as when I have a problem, there's 30 different avenues for me to figure out how to resolve it. Whereas the avenues to resolve problems are much less. When you are a person of color, I mean, even within the Hispanic community.
Yes, that's true. So, you're not colorblind. Nobody's colorblind, but because of the way you grew up with different languages and cultures and religions, I mean, you've really seen things from an early age across the board. So, do you want to tell us a little bit about this project? The Norway Project, because the name of it, I don't really know what it's about.
Okay, yeah, I'm very excited about the Norway Project, and I just submitted my first draft for my first semester, but I'm going to be working with my professor in order to hopefully touch it up and get it published at some point in the future, which is the ultimate goal for it. And I think that I have a very good start, but it does still need some work. But I'm just going to try to touch on some of the premises.
Okay.
So are you familiar? I'll explain it anyways. The Human Development Index. Are you familiar with that?
No.
The Human Development Index.
Talking, but I don't know by the name.
The Human Development Index is a statistic put together by the United Nations. To me, in some ways, it does a very good job. In other ways, it also just reinforces the capitalist system. But I think that there are some good things within the United Nations in terms of cooperation.
Right.
Although they obviously also cooperate to do some bad
things as well.
So it's a mixed bag for me in terms of how I feel about them. But it is a statistic that they put together, so it judges a country's development and in turn, but it doesn't do it just.
Yes, yeah. Just the name when you said the Human Index, I'm just like, yes, I have seen. Some graphs or something about this, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it doesn't take it in terms of income, although income is one third of the equation. But the other important parts of the equation are health and also education.
Mm-hmm.
So it combines all these three things, and it's by no means a perfect equation to decide what's development and all that. But for the purpose of this, Norway has consistently ranked number one on this list. And Norway has consistently ranked number one on this list. The United States is number four on the list. However,
oh, is that high?
I want to touch on this. There's another statistic that I actually prefer over the Human Development Index called the Human Development Index Adjusted for Inequality. And Norway still remains number one when you adjust the Human Development Index for inequality, whereas the United States drops to, I think, 23. It's either 19,
okay,
it's somewhere between 19 and 23.
For inequality, wow.
Because what happens is since income is calculated into this, so it does still play a role. So the United States shoots way up because of its income, but then when you take into account how wealthy the wealthiest are and how poor the poorest are, they lose a lot of points when you take into account inequality. Whereas Norway, although they do have inequality, it's not a perfectly uniformed income base, but the inequality is much more manageable and much more reasonable. And I will get into that later. So I basically say that Norway is a great example, along with also the rest of the Scandinavian countries, are great examples of success, within particularly the wealthy countries of the world, success
mm-hmm.
within those countries. And in terms of social justice and equality and distribution of wealth. Now, this is an argument that goes on in my field fairly often. The counter argument for this that the conservatives always bring up is that Norway is an oil exporting country, so they just use the only reason they're able to be successful is that their income is so based on oil exports.
Oh.
And I basically go about in the first part of my paper discrediting this, saying, well, they do have oil exports, but that's just a source of income. Every country in the world has sources of income. It matters more not how you get the income, but more how the income is distributed amongst the population of people in order to benefit the most amount of people. And
makes sense. It's what you do with it.
Right, absolutely, absolutely. That's something that I think is very important. But this is an argument, the oil argument, or the oil argument against Norway, saying that discredits the Norwegian model of social democratic welfare, of the social democratic welfare state. This is a common argument that many, many conservatives use regularly.
It doesn't even make sense. Because, I mean, like you said, I mean, every country has, I mean, they get their money somewhere. So I don't understand how they get by with that argument.
Right, and I think that within my paper I do a pretty good job of discrediting this. So the first thing that I come to, and I think that it's also the most major point that this is just a terrible argument, is Norway didn't start exporting oil until, I have it somewhere. Norway didn't start exporting oil until 1973.
Okay, it's about 40 years, just about.
So
yeah.
It's been about 40 years. So I have the economic growth rates, we're sitting right here, of Norway since 1961. The average economic growth rate for the 12 years, so 1961 to 1972, prior to exporting oil, is 3.59%, whereas the average economic growth rate for the 12 years post-exporting oil was 3.51%. So they're very similar, and it's actually a little bit higher prior to exporting oil.
Right.
Oil hasn't, and if you look at it in the past 40 years, it's only been an average of 2.35%. Oil hasn't increased growth in Norway at all. It has, in some ways, shaped the economy differently, whereas Norway was based, prior to it, had a lot of fishing industry, shipping, and also commodity industry was what their economy was based on. When they discovered this oil, they transitioned their economy to an oil-based economy, and it plays a significant role in the way that their economy is shaped and the structure of their gross domestic product, but it hasn't created growth. And I think that I'm able to show that in this paper. And if that's not enough to discredit this argument, I think that the fact that of the top 10 oil exporters in the world, Norway is the only one to have an inequality rate that is even reasonable. I mean, the other top oil exporters are countries like Nigeria, Venezuela. The United States is also, although they import more than they export, is also, I think, number 9 or 10 on the oil export list. These are all countries with high levels of inequality.
Right. Yeah.
And so one of the key aspects of what I call the Norwegian model, which I think that is very valid in solutions to world issues, is one of the key issues is how they use this money. So I think that you had something on Facebook that was talking about how it's corrupt, that corporations are able to harness resources like oil they're not owned by anybody.
Right.
It's absolutely a public.
And take theirs, which is even worse. I mean, that's just outright theft.
Absolutely. And so, yeah, absolutely. And although Norway actually does not have, it's not fully owned by the state. They have is a a state-owned oil company, Statoil, that is publicly traded, but majority shared. The majority of the shares are owned by the government, and because of that reason, they've been able to control the usage of oil and the amount of exploitation that they've had of these resources. Because since the beginning of oil exports in Norway, they've always the government of Norway has made it a point to do it at a moderate rate and not do it at the quick rate that most oil companies, private oil companies, always, you know, they just try to withdraw oil as quickly as possible.
Sure, I mean, the greed factor enters in, but it seems like in Norway, common sense is entering in.
Right. And so they have what they do with a lot of this money that the government brings in from taxes and from revenue from the oil is they have a sovereign wealth fund. And this is a fund of money just basically owned by the government that they invest in other things outside of oil. And instead of just having economists and bankers run their sovereign wealth fund, they appointed a philosopher to judge the moral standing of their investments.
Wow. Now that has got to be unusual.
It's very unusual, and I also think that it's groundbreaking because there could be something to be said. Excuse me?
I said, I think that's wonderful. Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh no. Let's see. Where was I? I was talking about the sovereign wealth fund and the inequality rates of the different countries that are oil exporters. And I had got a message on Facebook. I think someone wants me to explain what inequality rate means. I mean, income inequality, within the countries. So the difference basically between the rich and the poor, and then where the middle class stands in all of this.
Right.
And we
are losing our middle class in this country anyway. I mean, people are going more to the poor end.
And a way that a statistic that they use to judge this is called the Gini coefficient. I don't know if you're familiar with this as well, or if you're familiar with this or not.
No,
the Gini coefficient is basically the Gini coefficient. Basically, is an equation that judges inequality strictly. So, my personal favorite statistic is the Human Development Index adjusted for inequality. So. The way they calculate this is they take the Human Development Index and they calculate in the Gini coefficient. So the Gini coefficient in Norway is 25.2, which is obviously zero would be absolute equality, income equality, whereas 100 would be absolute income inequality. It is largely considered that a Gini coefficient of over 40 is socially dangerous to society and is likely to cause unrest amongst the citizens, which can lead to violence and other sort of things. So Norway is 25.2, which is very significantly lower than the United States, which is, I believe, 40.2.
The Gini coefficient in the United States,
and they're above that threshold that's considered dangerous, and it's been increasing throughout the years.
Yeah, I would have put it at higher. So it's just at the danger point right now.
Right. It's at the danger point right now, and if it continues to increase, that's where you're likely to see higher rates of revolts and maybe things like Occupy Wall Streets, and only even on more extreme scales.
Right, more actual violence. and taking mm-hmm. over places. Okay, I could see that. What countries do you think right now, studying all of them, where is the most danger economically and then just actually physically, war and such? What areas do you put in your top five?
Obviously Israel-Palestine, who I guess we know that Palestine just, I haven't studied, I think you would know much more about this. Palestine got some sort of approval by the United Nations.
Yes, we were very happy yesterday. It was landmark. I mean, we know that it's not changing things immediately. In fact, Zionists were shooting at Palestinian fishermen today. However, out of 193 countries, like three countries just, I guess, didn't even show up. 138 voted to recognize them as a non-observer member. I mean, not a non-observer, but a non-like voting. You know, they upped them
right.
from the same kind of entity that the Vatican used to have or does have. Nine countries voted against it, United States and Israel, of course, being two. And 41 abstained. But 138 is really pretty good. So we were just saying, like, you know, now the world spoke. The world does not like what's going on. So that place is, that's a hotbed. It still is. But, I mean, you're studying these different countries. Where else?
Well, you know, one of the hot topics that a lot of people are frightened of is China.
Mm-hmm.
I actually take the stance that, although I suppose environmentally China is doing a lot of things, China's going along a lot of the same routes that the United States went in the beginnings of their development, which I don't necessarily approve of, but for me, I can't see how capitalist Americans can look at China and shame them for what they're doing when the United States has done everything the exact same way and show no remorse for it.
I agree completely. And the United States actually has companies over there in China having people work for almost nothing. That's why they had to put those nets around the factories because people were killing themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That was like one of the Apple subcontractors or something. But no,
right.
The United States sure has no room to be pointing fingers.
Right, absolutely. And I do think that perhaps in the future, if things keep going the same way that they are, there could be some trouble between the United States and China. But I don't think that it's so much being, because China's spoken out that they want it to be peaceful.
Mm-hmm.
And China has not historically been a warring country. And I think that if the issues do arise, they're going to come from oppression from the United States out of fear of China, not from China pushing the United States government to do anything other than just be fair.
Yeah. That makes
but,
sense. Yeah.
But
a lot of people do see China as a major, major threat.
They do, but I think that that's in a lot of ways overstated based on a lot of Americans' misunderstanding of Chinese culture.
Mm-hmm.
And also a certain level of bigotry that upper middle class, particularly in the United States, don't want to see people in China having competing with them. And because the upper middle class in the United States is used to it only being white Europeans competing with them.
right.
And at times Japanese. But even that, at the beginning of Japan's rise, inspired a lot of bigotry.
Well, what about Korea?
You know, I don't know a whole lot about. I'm presuming you're talking about the sort of North Korea, South Korea border dispute, and just the North Korea has. I guess they do have one nuclear missile.
Well, I mean, why shouldn't they? Look at how many we have. That's where I never understood why our imperial building country should be the only one with these weapons.
Absolutely.
You know?
And that brings me to my other point that of all this, the biggest threat to the world is the United States.
Yeah.
And the level of arrogance that the United States government shows around the world by basically flashing their guns and saying, we're going to do this, we're going to trump around any country that we want to, but if you
right.
do the same thing, we are going to then
drone you.
Take over your territory.
Yeah, we're going to take, and you know, it's like, we're going to take over your territory anyway, so just, you know, get used to it kind of thing. It's the way I, arrogance is a very good word. You picked a good word there.
And but now that being said, since this has been going on for so long, particularly in the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s, since this has been going on for so long, and then throughout the Cold War, the fear of communism and all that, the United States has been doing this for a long time. The thing is that they, by doing that, they've created such a large backlash. So what is the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, what is Al-Qaeda? It's a backlash against Western imperialism, and yes, they're very angry and very dangerous, but
and if
what
you
look at a lot.
Well, it's one of those things, if you study it, you may see that many people think that it was a CIA or a black ops operation in the first place. So, you know, there's like one man's terrorist is another's freedom fighter kind of thing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I'm actually more afraid of the crazies we have in power here than I am of the crazies elsewhere. And that's a horrible feeling.
They also don't have as near as much power as the ones who sit in power in the United States government, or even in power through the military-industrial complex, you know, in corporations that make huge profits off of bombings and war and armament. You know, one company, I guess Lockheed Martin is one, but there's you know, there's hundreds and hundreds of more around there that they bank off of.
It's a huge business, and they sell to everybody, which is, you know, I mean, our companies have been doing that, though, since it began. It was just in the past few years I found out that during the Second World War, IBM was selling, or actually they made some type of, like, pre-computer thingy that the different concentration camps used for keeping records. And I mean, it's like special order. IBM in this country made it for them. So, you know, the arms dealers in these companies, they don't have loyalties or morals or conscience. Their thing is greed, and they're going to sell wherever they can.
Yeah, greed and profit. I mean,
profit. Yeah.
The militant groups in Afghanistan were armed by United States companies in order to fight the Soviet Union in the region.
Exactly, or the Soviet, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, okay, you know, you've got this going, and now, you know, can't you people ever think ahead? know. Mm-hmm. No, they can't. Well, it's the immediate. Yeah.
I do think that there might be some sort, and this is my opinion, I think that there could be some sort of recognition in Washington that that's what happened, but they're so paranoid of a backlash, so they just keep digging the hole deeper, and they keep digging the hole deeper, and in my mind, that isn't the best solution. The best solution is autonomy for the people of the regions. And also, I do think, to some degree, economic help, but not economic help like the United States has participated in the past, which is an economic help for the benefit of corporations in the United States or businessmen, or even like the IMF and the World Bank. You obviously know those organizations. They give loans, but who's authorizing these loans?
What they ask in return. I mean,
right.
Talk about
absolutely.
Signing your
and
life.
They're profiteers.
Yeah, you sign your country's life away when you deal with them.
Mm-hmm. So the economic help should be absolutely. It shouldn't come with strings attached. It shouldn't come with even strings attached, such as this is what we decide economic development is, because I think that economic development in various cultures will appear differently. The idea of urbanization, this is a discussion that came in one of my classes. In bourgeois economics, urbanization is 100% necessary in economic development. I think that in some places, economic development won't necessarily look urban like it does here.
And, you know, I just think that with no interference, many countries, many cultures will do just fine.
Mm-hmm.
So developing our definition of developing them, and I say our, the governments, you're right. It's strictly for the corporations and things. There isn't a humanitarian act anywhere.
Right.
That we're doing, and so many people still talk about that. Well, you know, we're the great humanitarians, yada, yada. But only if it's a country that has some resources that we want or something like that, or that our multinationals want. Because otherwise, you know, it's just like, well, just let them starve to death and, you know, depend on churches and people of good intent to try to get some money or some food to them, because the government's not going to do it. It's sad. Well, what do you think? Do you think that Syria is like economically threatened? It's definitely war torn right now.
Yeah. Can I admit something to you?
Mm-hmm.
So when people ask about the region of specialization that I have, I tell them that I specialize in every region but the Middle East.
Okay.
And Northern Africa. So I don't really know much about the Syria situation.
Okay.
And so I know some about a little bit about Iran, but the Middle Eastern region is really not. If I have anything that I'm not very well read in and well informed, it's the Middle Eastern region. So I can answer some vague questions, but as far as Syria, I don't know too much about that.
Well, you know, you mentioned earlier Venezuela, and, you know, we just had another election, and Hugo Chavez got it. It was much bigger than what, you know, the lamestream media here was saying, oh, you know, he's probably not going to, and if he doesn't, there's going to be a riot and blah, blah, or if he does, there's going to be a riot.
It's going to be...
That was their wishful thinking. There was no riot. He got it by, like, 10 points or something.
It was 12%, and Fox News still made a huge deal about it, about how, oh, this is the closest election ever, which is true. But if anybody won the presidency by 12% in the United States, do you know how much of a mandate that would be? They were calling Obama's victory by 2% a mandate.
Yeah,
so what does Chavez have with 12%? He should, I mean, the United States, he could do whatever he wanted to do.
Yeah, no, it's, and he has actually, or they have actually nationalized a lot of things in Venezuela. How is that working?
It's working very well. So since, I don't have particular statistics, but I have done some reading on this. Since Chavez has taken power, Venezuela is a very highly unequal society.
Yeah.
Highly unequal society, and it's still a very highly unequal society. Their Gini coefficient, as I was talking about earlier, has dipped, I think, from something like it was in the mid-60s, I think, before Chavez took over, and now it's into the either the high 40s or like 50. So it's taken a significant dip. And the poverty rate has fell, I think, down to 18% from something above 40%. If anyone's listening, and don't quote me on my statistics, you can look it up and see that the changes are significant. My numbers are a little bit fuzzy in my head right now. But the other thing that people say is, oh, Chavez has limited freedom of speech. Chavez has done the opposite. He's given the people the freedom to speak instead of just and he hasn't limited the private media is up and running. Is up and running, and they're all negative Chavez all day.
Right. That's the point, because they were very much against him, and he hadn't closed them down. Nobody shut him down. While, you know, we were hearing here from the media about how closed everything was, and like you said, I mean, what he's done, negative, but, you know, a closed society or somebody who's being put upon so much doesn't have that much freedom of the press or of the media. So
the other thing in regards to freedom of speech in Venezuela, rate is up. Why is the literacy rate up? Because he's providing education to people that generally wouldn't get education. Mm-hmm. Well, if that's not improving freedom of speech, I really don't know what it is.
Right.
You're enabling people to read and write and actually give their opinion, in a more significant way than just by hearsay and word of mouth.
Right. Practically smoke signals. So, no, there's been a lot. And, you know, they have, when we've had problems here, they've actually tried or offered help, just like Cuba offered help during Katrina. Of course, the United States would turn it down. But they've been, like, the bigger country, actually. So, yeah, I have very good feelings about Venezuela myself. But, see, I'm just trying to hit now on different. Okay, we've got Scandinavia, South America, Australia. Have you been studying anything with Australia?
The only thing I know that about Australia is that they a fairly developed society, and that they do a good job at distributing their income in a somewhat equal sense. But Australia has a problem with their indigenous society. There's indigenous peoples who are a very small percentage still live in Australia, but the inequality rates or the education rates and health rates and income rates of the indigenous people are significantly lower than their white imperials.
Okay.
So there are, but that's not a commonly discussed issue. And I actually, if you don't mind, I had one more thing I wanted to touch on in my Norway paper that I think is a very significant thing. The difference between particularly the Scandinavian model, the Norwegian model, and the model used in the United States.
Mm.
So there's two different types of welfare so the type in the United States is called the liberal welfare state. It's called the liberal welfare state, whereas in Norway it's called the social democratic social democratic welfare state, or some people call it democratic socialism, but the technical term that they call it is social democratic welfare. There's a very critical difference between that, and I actually want to read a quote, not one of my quotes, but from my paper that I drew from, if I can find it here. Here we go. So here's it describes the liberal welfare state. The liberal welfare state regime is characterized by the circumscribed role of the state and the high reliance on market solutions. You know what I mean by market solutions, right? Mm-hmm. Market solutions are like what they call, quote unquote.
Hello? Jordan? He's dropped. We will try to get him back here. Don't know what happened. Let me just dial it up here.
Hello?
There you... Okay. I was just trying to call you back.
I'm sorry about that. I don't know if it's...
It just showed that you dropped, and so I was just trying to call you back. I don't know. But you didn't drop it. I mean, you didn't hang up or anything.
No, my phone might have dropped the call. I don't get fantastic signal where I'm at. I mean, it's reasonable signal. I had to step outside so that it would work better.
Oh, okay. It was too cold for that. Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
So I'm touching on two different types of welfare states. So the liberal welfare state, which is what we have here in the United States, versus the social democratic welfare state, also sometimes called democratic socialism, that they have in Norway. So I'm taking this quote from Jonas Edlund, which is a book that I read on Norway. And basically he describes the liberal welfare state, which is the United States, as a state regime characterized by the circumscribed role of the state and the high reliance of market solutions. And by market solutions, he's talking about you know, the quote-unquote free market that is so worshipped in the United States. Social spending and tax revenue levels are relatively low. Offers a basic, so while others that are better off are supposed to protect themselves via various private forms of insurance. State benefits are generally means-tested or provided at a low flat rate. In the social democratic regime, as in Norway, social protection is linked to citizenship, and that's the critical difference, that everyone has access to
everyone,
all of the programs, citizenship, and in some cases, long-term residency. Most of the population are covered by the core programs of the welfare state. Benefits are either income-related together with a rather high basic security level for those with low or no income, or provided as citizens' rights. Social spending levels are comparatively high and are mainly financed by tax revenues. So Norway collects 43.2% of its gross domestic product in tax revenues, compared to the United States, which collects 25.1% of its gross domestic product in tax revenues. This allows them to extend all of their programs of public education. It allows the public education, health care, much better than our own health care system to everyone. And also things such as free education up through the university level based on credentials and not just wealth. So the smartest of the students go to the best schools, and they're based on credentials and that sort of thing, as opposed to just privilege and entitlement wealth. Another thing that's also very neat about Norway is they send every student, I believe that it's every student when they graduate high school, abroad.
Oh, my God.
Visit other countries on the government dollar.
Wow, I did not know that. That's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. And they send them various different places. It's not all students go to the same place. They send them basically all over the world.
Wow. But that whole thing about travel broadening the mind and all this, it's true. And that also, though, they send them every, I mean, different places. They get to just experience. How long, I mean, is it like a month trip or what? Do you know what they have a time frame? I mean, do they go and work or do they just go visit? Okay. We are really having trouble here. Okay, you're
Hello.
Back.
I'm sorry about that. Yeah, I don't know. My phone is losing signal.
Oh. Well, I was asking, how long do they send them abroad for?
I actually don't know that.
Yeah. It's not
I believe
the,
that it's a
not to go and work. It's just to go and sort of tour.
I believe that it's, I really don't know the details behind it.
Okay.
They may actually, it may differ in, depending on the student and what the student's goals are.
Sure.
But I can't say whether they work or not. I actually, to some degree, suspect that they might work, to some degree,
mm-hmm.
but I really don't know that for a fact.
But no, I mean, it just seems like that. I mean, so much more is given, and it's not. You know, people talk about, oh, you just can't give people everything, but you can give people a lot, and then, I mean, the country is actually paid back by having smart people who know their jobs, and also, they have more in the way of workers' benefits, I believe, don't they? As far as
absolutely, unemployment insurance, 1 year of maternity leave,
right?
Plus, I believe 6 months of paternity leave,
right? Which is just like, I mean, here that's unheard of.
Paid maternity and paid paternity leave, legally required by the state.
No, things like that, I mean, we in this country, we can't really wrap our minds around countries like that. I mean, I know people here who, in fact, well, I have a friend whose husband gets 1 week paid vacation a year, and he can take another week, but it's not paid.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
that sounds about right.
Yeah. Isn't that disgusting? You know, and that there again, it's just that whole drudgery thing. People don't like their jobs. And even if they don't mind what they do so much, they don't like the companies they work for or the people they work for. So most people that I know are not happy with their jobs. And yet go ahead.
Which brings me to another point that I think is really the most significant, at least within my definition of what capitalism is, the most significant movement that Norway has taken to decapitalize, if you want to call it that, their workforce, their workforce, is required to do business in Norway, one of the wealthiest countries per capita in the world. It is required that employees are able to elect one-third of the board members.
All right.
Do I think that this has gone far enough? No, I think that it will gradually progress to be more, which is really what I view as the what will become of capitalism. You'll see companies moving away from a bureaucratic CEO to a run by the employees.
Well, to the
more and more
means of production being owned and run by the employees.
By the employees, that's what I mean. Having control, owning and running as opposed to being, in Marxist terms, alienated from the means of production.
Right. That, I mean, I don't know. Do you know what Mondragon is in Basque Country in Spain? Have you ever?
No, I do not.
that's there's something like 80,000 people. There's a it's major community-owned cooperatives. And ever since I heard about that, all you have to do is Google it. And there's movies, old movies about it and things. It started back in the 60s, a priest and five of his students. But it is just, I mean, if you can have a crush on an institution, that would be mine. I think, oh, my God, this must be our future. It must be. But everything, they started out with a school and then a bank. And so that they own the bank, and like what you're saying, the people who work there, they're the owners, and they run it. They vote on, you know, the management, blah blah, and who's going to be the president this year, whatever. But it's all worker controlled, and I mean it you can see it works. So what you're saying, like the Norway's plan, like you would like for them to ease into this more and more beyond a third. But yeah, a third is
much more
than we have in this country. So, I mean, they're definitely on the right track.
Yes, absolutely. And, I mean, that's the ultimate goal, is to avoid alienating the workers and give them a control over what's going on, and really, if work is a very significant portion of your life, which it is, give them control over their own lives.
Right. I mean, it's horrible. Yeah. If you work 8 hours a day and you hate your work, you have to, you know, drive an hour there and an hour back. We're talking 50 hours a week. And, you know, and then you worry about it or think about it when you're not there because you hate it so much. I mean, what is that? That is not...
that is a life of misery.
Exactly. So just having the say-so about it, and usually the working hours become smaller and benefits greater, and as much gets done. These people
and you're not going to have a one person or a group of people at the top of the company that are making 300 to 500 times more than the average employee.
Exactly.
You know, the difference in income is going to be significantly greater or significantly less.
I've seen something was like 1 to 4 or 8. I haven't, in these different companies, I haven't seen anything more than 8 times for the top head honchos. But a lot.
What do you mean? In what companies?
I'm trying to think, but I was talking about like more than Mondragon. But years
okay,
ago,
okay, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I
would say
that,
it's much more than that within company,
oh, here,
within
oh
a typical
God.
Corporation.
Yeah. But
right,
here,
I think
I read a few years ago, well, quite a few, that Ben and Jerry's ice cream was, I think that was one of the companies that was doing like 4 times what the lowest one was paid. Not a bad, I mean, you know, compared to, like you say, 1 to 300 or 500, that's just disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
We have just 1 minute. This went fast, Jordan. What would you like to wind up with? You have a minute.
Well, I have nothing really closing, but I will try to keep you posted on what's going on with this Norway paper and other things that I'm doing in terms of research. If you are interested, I do some political and economic talk on Twitter. It's at Jordan W. Scott. But other than that,
I'm the last person in the world, I think, to get on Twitter, but I have just done it, and I don't know what to do with it, but I will find out. So, Jordan,
and also
Scott.
Facebook, although I probably do more on Facebook, honestly, than I do on Twitter, but just because the capability of putting things down. But
right,
and I'm going to be...
And on Facebook, you are Jordan Scott. So,
yes.
And we'll post that on that Air Marte page on there, too. So, thank you so much. I'm sorry about the Skype and the phone and all of that, but thanks for your patience.
Well, that's all right. It's been a pleasure. I really appreciate it.
Oh, I enjoyed it. So have a good weekend.
All right, you too. We'll be in touch.
Okay, yes. Bye-bye.
Block and his lies. If we know of him and his activity, we can see through his lies. Emma Block is 70. What do you mean by camouflage? I mean false patch of two spirituality.